Welcome to this podcast from the Commonwealth Club of California, a nonprofit and nonpartisan forum open to the public. To attend a Commonwealth Club event, check out our program listing at www.commonwealthclub.org. Now we join today's program of the Commonwealth Club.
Good evening and welcome to tonight's meeting of Inforum, a division of the Commonwealth Club by and for people in their 20s and 30s, with a mission to inspire debate around civic issues. I'm Barbara Rogers, anchor of CBS 5 Eyewitness News at noon. Political independence has brought high hopes to many African states over the last half century. Sadly, these nations have been overwhelmed by obstacles to acceptable public health standards. The HIV/AIDS epidemic has had a devastating effect on communities and economies. Access to clean drinking water is still a problem for hundreds of millions of people. Preventable diseases such as malaria thrive in impoverished areas. When asked what are the major health issues facing the African continent today, many people answer AIDS, HIV, family planning, malaria, and malnutrition. When asked what is being done to develop the proper health systems to address these issues, the answers might not come so quickly. Tonight, our expert panel is gathered to discuss the major health problems in Africa and share messages of hope. They are Dr. Jay Kiesling, a professor of chemical engineering and bioengineering at the University of California, Berkeley, and a director of the Physical Biosciences Division and head of the Synthetic Biology Department at Lawrence Berkeley National Laboratory. His current research involves perfecting a lower-cost production method of the antimalarial drug Artemisinin. Dr. Joanne Leslie, a trustee of Freedom from Hunger since 2002, has 25 years' experience as a staff member or consultant for the World Bank, the World Health Organization, UNICEF, and the International Center for Research. As a professor at UCLA, Dr. Leslie taught courses in nutrition and women's health with an emphasis on household factors related to hunger and malnutrition. She is the co-editor of two books, including Food Policy, Integrating Supply, Distribution, and Consumption. Maudie Makange is the program officer for Sub-Saharan Africa at the Global Fund for Women, the world's largest nonprofit grant-making foundation focusing exclusively on advancing international women's rights. Prior to the Global Fund, she served as program officer for Africa at the Pacific Institute for Women's Health, where she was responsible for Africa-based training and evaluation projects in reproductive health and women's empowerment. And Dr. Nancy Padian is the executive director of UCSF's Women's Global Health Imperative. She is an internationally recognized expert in the heterosexual transmission of HIV, and her joint research with the University of Zimbabwe on a program teaching women negotiating strategies for condom use has been profiled in the New York Times and Scientific American. Please welcome our panel. I'd like to start by having each one of our panelists first give us a brief, maybe about a minute, assessment of what they think is the major health problem facing the continent of Africa and how the work that they are doing relates to that problem. And we'll start with you, Dr. Kiesling.
Well, I'm biased when I talk about what I think is the most important problems facing Africa. In my mind, it's access to affordable drugs. The research I'm working on is to produce an antimalarial drug, artemisinin, which is a cure, and it was discovered by the Chinese back in 153 BC, actually, when they used it for several treatments, one being malaria. And it was pretty much lost until about the Vietnam War era when new antimalarial drugs were needed. The problem with it is that it's produced from a plant and extracted from a plant using environmentally unfriendly methods. And it's very expensive. For you and me as a traveler, we might pay $20 to $40. For people in Africa, the World Health Organization negotiated a price of around $2.50 for a treatment, which is a cure. But this is still an order of magnitude too high. So my lab is engineering microbes to produce the drug, and in the process, we'll get a drug that's being produced using the same methods that we expect of our drugs here in the Western world, but at a price that is significantly below the antimalarial drugs that are currently being used. So this is using some very high-tech biotechnology to engineer these microbes to take the genes from the plant and essentially get a microbe to reproduce what the plant does.
Thank you. Dr. Leslie.
Well, all four of the issues that you mentioned are, of course, important and, as I hope we'll discuss in the course of the next hour, sort of synergistically each one can make the other worse. But I think it's really arguable that hunger and undernutrition is the most important health risk facing people in Africa, if only because of the number of people that are affected. There are 200 million, at least, people malnourished in Africa, and perhaps more tellingly, 33 million children under the age of five. That's more than one out of every four children in Africa. So this is a very widespread problem. And the fact that especially the children are undernourished makes them more susceptible to all of the other infectious diseases that we're also talking about here tonight. Now, the work that Freedom from Hunger does, and I'm a trustee of Freedom from Hunger and a big supporter of their work, of course, is affects this problem in a very direct and constructive way at the household level by combining microloans to women with nutrition and health information so that they can immediately put the increased income that they have to improving the household nutrition, especially the child nutrition.
Thank you. And Mari Makange?
The Global Fund for Women takes a very holistic view of health, and so health means the environment in which women live. For example, we focus on women because we know that they are the most vulnerable when it comes to any type of health risks or economic risks. And for that reason, we have decided that the strategy to make a difference is to make grants that are flexible, that women's organizations can use to, whether they're addressing maternal mortality, which are highly preventable, or whether they're addressing loans for women's economic survival, that these are strategies that women can make their own decisions about their lives. The fact that women cannot make decisions about their sexual and reproductive lives is a key problem on the continent, and I think gets to many of the issues, whether we're talking about HIV/AIDS, maternal mortality, malnutrition, or any other issue you can think about. So that's the angle that we focus on, and we are fortunate in that we've been able to make grants to the tune of $11 million on the African continent, and we're trying to educate other donors to the importance of taking a gender lens to the work that they're doing.
Thank you. And Dr. Padian.
Thank you. HIV/AIDS is certainly one of the greatest problems of the African continent. In fact, when you work there and then come back here and even in work I do in Asia, I mean, it's really clearly this is more than anything an African problem, and particularly a Southern African problem. Is it the most important health problem in Africa? I think that's really hard to say. And in fact, my work coincides very much with Maudie's work, and that is, if I had to characterize one major cause of health problems on the continent, it would actually be gender disparities in the exact same way that Maudie described. My work in particular looks at that with regard to HIV/AIDS, and we essentially have two lines of research. One is examining tools that women might be able to use to protect themselves against HIV/AIDS that don't require negotiating male condoms, that are methods they can use, microbicides, diaphragms, female condoms. Maybe we'll talk a little bit more about that. But I also look at some of the same strategies that you just heard from the previous two speakers at looking at ways to make women economically independent and to empower them economically so that they will have a voice and will be able to make decisions and will be able to decide under what circumstances they have sex and with whom, and will not have to rely on partners for various aspects of their lives.
Thank you. Since you were talking about HIV/AIDS, and of course we always hear that in relationship to the African continent, let's start out by talking about clinical trials on an HIV vaccine are currently underway in the U.S. and several other countries. What is the status of vaccine development? And Dr. Padian, I think we could start with you on that.
I have to confess to the audience, this is not my area of expertise. It's my really, but I can tell, so I my opinion is really that of an informed layperson, I would have to say. And there are various vaccines in early stages of development. We are still many years away from having one that we really think will work, but the research is hot and exciting, and I think it's a very promising area of research, but I think it'll be 15 or so years before we really have one that works. So we need to look for other ways of preventing infection.
Dr. Kiesling, would you like to comment on that too?
I think you're right. It's clearly one of the most exciting areas of research. It's also one of the most difficult areas of research, and there are such significant challenges. Even if you look at, say, malaria vaccines, the ones that have been developed are only partially effective. So clearly drugs are going to have a very major role in treating these diseases for many years to come.
Uganda's AIDS prevention program and the ABC, or Abstinence Be Faithful Condoms program, has been notably successful in reducing HIV transmission. However, it has also been noted that in other parts of the world, in Russia, for example, different routes of transmission, such as injection drug use, has caused a steady rise in HIV infections and AIDS cases. What are the various transmission routes in Africa, and how have changing routes of transmission affected the way prevention programs are implemented? And maybe, Marty, you might want to start with that.
Thank you. I actually want to go back to women's economic status and women's social status in society, because I think that more than the problem with the ABC formula is that it is regarded as a formula, that once you introduce this into a community, that it's a ready solution to what is a huge problem, a problem which is very complex. And in fact, when you break down the data, what you find is that even if women have the information, even if they've been informed, when it comes down to negotiating with their partners, they're not able to do that. For married women, they're the ones at most risk, in fact, from their partners who are not being faithful. And the abstinence programs, it finds that in the long term, even if young people pledge to be abstinent for in the short term, in the long term, they do not use condoms faithfully and, in fact, engage in more unsafe sex. And so there are a lot of problems with the ABC approach. And what we try to stress is that we have to take a more comprehensive view, which looks at gender inequalities, which also looks at the government's role as well in taking leadership and prioritizing health issues, reproductive health issues. We're glad to see, for example, with Zambia, which recently had a debt relief package, that what they've decided to do, one of the things they've decided to do, is to increase the allocation towards health. And we're hoping that reproductive health will also receive a larger portion of that funding in the past, which has been quite negligible across the continent.
Could I just add a quick thing?
Yes.
I need to get in here the fact that it's not entirely clear whether the decrease in Uganda is attributed to ABC. In fact, it's messy. It's a messy package. It's not a program that was rigorously implemented or evaluated. It's also not 100% clear that decline will be sustained. So I just think it's important to put that in context. You asked about other, unquestionably heterosexual transmission is the major mode of transmission on the continent. You asked about others. There are definitely, depending upon where you are. For example, I was just in Tanzania and Zanzibar. There's a burgeoning community of men who have sex with men. I know that there are hidden communities in other places in Africa. Injection drug use, some of the same risks we see here, not to the extent. And also, you may have heard, there is some transmission from unhygienic use of needles, which I think is important but negligible relatively. It's a heterosexual epidemic.
When we talk about stopping the transmission of HIV and AIDS, we get into a lot of cultural questions and questions of morality. And how does this affect, in fact, in 2003, there was an article in the Christian Science Monitor that said the Bush administration's regulations that ban AIDS to groups who to groups who perform, yes, right, aid to groups who perform or advocate abortion has caused at least a 36% decrease in funding for family planning programs. That coupled with religious teachings that are prevalent means that condom use is also discouraged. encouraged in some African countries, which has an impact on the spread of HIV. What can be done when you're working with those kinds of circumstances to encourage these programs? And any one of the panelists who wants to tackle that.
You want to give it a shot first?
I think it's extremely problematic to have the export of U.S. policy on the African continent. Even before that policy was exported, I think the social cultural context is such that it's very difficult to make improvements in the HIV epidemic. But the introduction now of the gag rule, which is what we're talking about, has in fact closed down clinics, which were not only providing counseling to women who perhaps needed information on what to do if faced with an unplanned pregnancy, but it was also closing services just for the provision of contraception. And so the effect has been that women who need contraception on a regular basis have not been able to access those. And so that means that Africa, for example, has about 20% contraceptive use in terms of the percentage of women who have access to contraceptive use compared to the U.S., where it's about 75%. And so the U.S. policy has had tremendous and very detrimental impacts, and we're seeing that extended to other areas of reproductive rights as well. And so it's just added on top of any kind of cultural norms that are organic to the African continent.
So then, since you do have all of those issues to deal with, is there a way that you approach the problem differently there in terms of getting around that?
Well, we always try to continue educating donors about the fact that, if they're not accepting U.S. funding, that they themselves invest in reproductive rights, that they, in fact, support organizations, especially community-based organizations that are working on these issues. And I think that the organizations that are most involved in addressing these problems are often overlooked by the largest donors. And so we really focus on the community-based organizations who are not really on the radar screen, but who are doing tremendous work. And with only an injection of $7,000 or $10,000, are able to scale that up. And they're breaking the taboo around sexuality, which you have to do in order to talk about HIV/AIDS, in order to talk about maternal mortality. You have to break taboos around sexuality in the first place.
I just wanted to add that I think it's important for everyone to know that it's not all U.S. money that's limited that way. I mean, for example, the National Institutes of Health doesn't hold you to the same standard. So that said, I wanted also to comment on the cultural aspect which you brought up. And I think it's important to note that I know this is true for the Global Fund, and I hope that it's true for my research as well, and that is we are working with partners in those countries that are part of that culture. So the idea that, you have an American-based program that you can just plop down there is not the way that it works. I think organic was a great word for that, and our research is organic. And the bottom line, just to keep in mind, is those policies by the U.S. government are not evidence-based. They are not ones that are proven effective.
Dr. Lett, I was just getting ready to ask you. You deal with hunger. And can you talk about how hunger plays into this whole issue of the transmission of HIV and AIDS?
Well, first, let me just, I will get right to that, but this question of the detrimental effects of applying U.S. sort of politically based policies goes beyond the HIV/AIDS issue, and what came to my mind as I was listening to the discussion is that we developed in the hunger and malnutrition field a policy for a while of giving massive amounts of food aid, primarily or substantially, in order to get rid of surpluses, in order to assist the agricultural sector in this country. Then when there were no longer surpluses, then we suddenly cut back on our food aid, which may actually have been, from a policy viewpoint, a good move, but it was imposing something that was motivated by more by U.S. political needs than by the needs of the African continent. In terms of the relationship between the HIV/AIDS epidemic and the hunger and undernutrition problem, it's certainly true that, as with any infectious disease, you will be more susceptible and you will become sicker with HIV/AIDS if you start out being undernourished. But I would say that the bigger issue is, in a sense, the other direction of causality, that because we are losing so many adults in their prime economic and reproductive years to the HIV/AIDS epidemic, we are exacerbating what was already a widespread problem of rural poverty. And we have families that now have no really able-bodied adults to support what is a growing group of orphans. And even though they are substantially protected by the cultural practice of you never abandon a child that is a relative of yours, so they will get taken in by aunts and uncles and grandparents. We have now grandparents who are trying to support 18 or 20 children, and there's just no way that they can do that in any kind of a way that provides good nutrition.
It seems that there is not as much attention being focused on this issue now that it has shifted more so to the African continent. In the work that each of you does, do you see that people are not giving the kind of support from other countries in terms of financial support, sending volunteers, all of the kinds of things that would help with this problem, the whole range of problems that have resulted from this? What is your experience? What are you seeing?
Speaking for HIV/AIDS and my work there, I mean, it's certainly not. I think people have grown more used to the fact that it's an African problem. So the novelty has sort of worn off, and in that respect, I think that the interest has declined. I think another thing that's happened there, though, is that with tremendous influxes of money for treatment, that there is an emphasis now on treatment. And actually, one point on nutrition is the potency of antiretrovirals is, to a certain extent, affected by your nutrition. It's more difficult, I think, maybe to think about prevention. And people have sort of gotten swept away by treatment. And the reality is that even if there were enough money for treatment for everyone who is eligible for the rest of their lives, which there is far from, you're still not going to make a dent in the epidemic without a focus on prevention. And I think funds have dwindled somewhat away from that.
Anybody else want to add anything? Yes.
Well, I would just actually pick up on a point that both Nancy and Mwadi have made already, which is that I think the most effective interventions we have finally learned, and it's taken us probably longer than it should have to learn this in Africa, is not to be bringing in a lot of outside experts, not to be bringing in a lot of outside programs that say this village needs water, that village needs a clinic, this village over here needs something else, but in fact to do things like the Global Funds projects, like the Credit with Education programs of Freedom from Hunger and other groups, where loans and training are given at the household level, usually to women because they do have this important dual economic and domestic role, and then they can make the choices of how to spend that increased income to address the problems that their families have. And they are in a much, much better position to judge than we are what would be the priorities for. So we just need to help them get a little bit of a way of digging themselves out of poverty.
You mentioned, all of you, you talked about treatment and the fact that treatment is now available, but it is not so readily available in African countries because of the cost. Dr. Kiesling, patents held by pharmaceutical companies on life-saving AIDS drugs are often a source of great political strife and trade rifts between the developed and developing world. You at UC Berkeley signed an agreement with the native Samoan people to share half the profits made from an anti-AIDS drug that you are working on, derived from a native Samoan tree. How did this agreement come about, and is it something that could be a model for other countries in the future?
The work you're referring to is our work on an anti-HIV drug that's in very early stages. It comes from a tree that grows natively in Samoa called the mamala tree. And healers long ago discovered that they could treat various viral diseases with basically a tea made of the bark of this plant. Hepatitis was one of the diseases that they were actually treating with the tea of the plant. The problem is that if this drug is ever approved as an anti-HIV drug, they'll cut down the rainforests and they'll plant many trees and harvest those, farm the trees. And so not only do you have the problem of cutting down the rainforest where there may be many other trees available, you know, then pharmaceutical companies will come in and take this drug and actually make the money on it. So we decided that since their healers had actually discovered the drug, that we should be returning something to them. Our goal is to find the genes in the plant, get microbes to produce the drug so that we don't have to cut down rainforests and produce the drug, and at the same time return to them half of the royalties that the University of California might earn from something like this. It's a long way off, but I think it is a model for how we should treat indigenous peoples and their discoveries, because there are bound to be many more of these drugs out there, and they deserve to be compensated for it.
We talked a little bit earlier about how the AIDS crisis, HIV/AIDS crisis, has played into instability in these countries. Could any of you address some of that more in terms of how, by eliminating a lot of the young people in these countries, by weakening police and military forces, by losing trained professionals, how this creates more instability for countries that are struggling?
I can give some examples. Just the burden of care that falls upon women due to the HIV/AIDS crisis. What happens is that girls are pulled out of school to care for relatives. If a breadwinner is lost, then that means that there's no money to pay school fees. And if there's a little bit of money, then the preference is given for boys' education. So definitely gender disparities show up once again once the epidemic starts hitting at the family level. In educational institutions, obviously, we've seen also teachers being impacted, not only teachers being decreased in numbers, but also in terms of absenteeism of students or girls who have to care for family members. And I want to take a step back, and I want to look at another context. I want us to look at the impact just of the macroeconomic context and what that does with HIV/AIDS. If you're looking at a continent that is in a state of vulnerability because of the fact that with regards to exports, with regards to industrialization, with regards to the negotiation power it does not have vis-a-vis developing countries, then HIV/AIDS just much easily becomes an epidemic because Africa itself doesn't have a negotiating role, and then the impact falls hardest on women. So I think we also need to look at the policies of the IMF, of the World Bank, and how these trickle down to impact individual families and to impact health and health outcomes.
Just to add quick,
yes. Uh-huh.
Just to speak from my own work, I mean, the way that it's most obvious is in the healthcare workforce that's necessary to deal with this epidemic. So building in part on what Mwadi said, and the fact that, once again, even if hypothetically there were enough treatment to roll out for everyone, and there's not enough workforce, there's not enough, you know, the healthcare infrastructure is too fragile. Now, in part, that's due to HIV/AIDS, and, you know, in fact, to a significant part. Another issue, though, of course, is a brain drain where people are oftentimes inclined. They, for example, and where I do most of my work in Zimbabwe, they still have a brilliant medical school, and they train them, and then people go to where you can make a dollar. And sadly, one of the side effects of having treatment monies and be not equal across the continent is that there are more jobs in countries that actually have more AIDS monies. So I don't think that that's an intended consequence, but it's exacerbating the brain drain.
Yes, Dr. Leslie.
Just one small other way that we have seen the HIV/AIDS epidemic impact households. This came out of some research that Freedom from Hunger had done on factors, looking at factors that would push poor families from marginally being able to get along into a real economic crisis where, for example, they might not be able to pay back the loans that they had taken out. And it turns out that household expenditures on funerals are a major expenditure. And when you have not just a funeral once every few years, but you're starting to have to undertake the costs of several funerals a year, this is a real drain on family incomes that were only just barely holding the household together.
We've spent a lot of time talking about HIV/AIDS, and clearly it is a problem, but I was surprised to learn earlier this year about the numbers when you're talking about malaria on the African continent, and it's really a bigger problem, I think, than most people think. According to the Global Health Council, there are annually over 300 million cases of malaria, resulting in over 1 million deaths. On June 29th of this year, the Senate Appropriations Committee recommended fully funding the President's Malaria Initiative at $225 million. If the funds do go through, what advances can we expect in malarial research, Dr. Kiesling?
I first want to say that I think this kind of funding is really important. Certainly, the funding from the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation has really changed the face of malaria and the research in the area of malaria and drugs. When we made one of our initial discoveries on producing this anti-malarial drug before we had gotten funding from the Gates Foundation, several pharmaceutical companies came to me and said, gosh, we'd really like to use your discovery, but we can't pay you for the rest of the research that's going to allow you to complete the work. Our stockholders wouldn't allow us to put money into this because we don't make profits from the drugs we sell in Africa. And I think this is one of the really sad things about the diseases there is that there's no profit to be made, and so pharmaceutical companies won't do further research. So this kind of funding, I think, is extremely important. Hopefully we'll have an effective vaccine in the not-so-distant future. And the problem is that the drugs we have out there that are inexpensive, affordable to people, are largely ineffective. And the ones that are expensive are very effective, but people can't afford them. So there's a real problem. And then if you look down the road, artemisinin is one of the last drugs that we really have available to us. If plasmodium gets resistant to it, as it has to the quinine-based drugs, then where's the next drug going to be? If you don't have research going into the next generation of antimalarial drugs, then there'll be nothing out there before we get a vaccine. So I think this is really important.
So how does the production of a drug that can be expensive, and you said you don't have the amount of money that you really need to keep developing, how does it make it to market? How will artemisinin get there?
Well, one thing that's important to note is that the Gates Foundation now has funded this. We have a partnership with the Institute for One World Health. And Amaris Biotechnologies, a small biotech company in Emeryville. And the partnership has gotten this money from the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation really to finish the research and bring this drug to market. And I think this is going to be really important. The Gates Foundation has put in over $1 billion into drugs, and they're funding all aspects of malaria. They're funding production of plants that produce this drug on a larger scale. They're funding microbial production. They're funding next-generation drugs. They're also funding work in vaccines.
All right. Do any of the rest of you want to? Yes, Mulati.
Oops, sorry.
If I can put a plug for prevention, that as much as it's wonderful to see all this money being put into research for vaccines, that there is a lot more that we can do in the short term if we focus on prevention. And if we focus on improving access to clean water, if we focus and put some funding into sanitation efforts, then obviously cases of malaria will go down. And so I wish more attention would sort of go to what is preventable and what we can do right now. And so that's the kind of education that we try to do too. So it's sort of
does one area get shortchanged when the funding is allocated? Does the area of prevention get shortchanged when there is something bright on the horizon in terms of prevention or vaccine? I mean, in terms of a cure or a vaccine, do your prevention efforts then fall down in terms of funding?
Comparatively, there's less money for prevention, although here, too, the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation has really been outstanding in terms of their HIV prevention programs. So in terms of governmental programs, from the U.S. government, for example, there's far more money in treatment than prevention. So I think there is some aspect of that. Coming back to a point that you made, though, at the very beginning of this round of questions, I think we also have to go back to patent laws and the fact that it's important to develop new drugs, bring them to market. Of course, I agree about prevention. But it's also possible for pharmaceutical industries to make drugs that we know that are available, to make generic drugs and to make drugs that we know are expensive. There's many ways to subsidize those from the developed world, to make them available in other ways. So I think we need to look at that as well.
And yes, Dr. Leslie, you wanted to add something.
Because Mwadi very rightly brought up the issue of prevention in terms of malaria, I just want to make sure that everyone in the audience is aware of one of the very most effective ways of preventing malaria now is insecticide-impregnated bed nets, which can be produced quite inexpensively and which we are now seeing spreading in a number of African countries. And again, if you combine them with something like a micro-lending project that allows people to have just a little bit more disposable income, then they can go out and buy these insecticide-impregnated bed nets themselves. And we have seen in Ghana and Burkina Faso, and I'm sure in a number of other countries, that the demand is there for them. And while we're waiting for this higher-tech research, we could and should be getting insecticide-impregnated bed nets into every rural household.
How widely are those available right now?
Well, they're being produced. Ironically, some of the best production is going on in Vietnam, and then they're being shipped from Vietnam and being purchased in Africa. There are efforts underway, and perhaps others know more about this, to get local production of high-quality insecticide-impregnated bed nets in Africa. But they're still not covering a large percentage of the households.
For our radio audience, you are listening to the Commonwealth Club's Inform program, and tonight we're talking about the health of Africa. I'm Barbara Rogers, and I'm here with Dr. Jay Kiesling of UC Berkeley, Dr. Joanne Leslie of Freedom from Hunger, Mwadi Makenge of the Global Fund for Women, and Dr. Nancy Padian of UC San Francisco. Let's switch now to talk about African women and their risk of dying during pregnancy. According to statistics, it is 1 in 16, while in North America, women have a risk of about 1 in 3,700 of dying in pregnancy. What are the particular ways that family planning is important to increasing quality of health in Africa and working on this problem? Who would like to start on that one?
You got it?
Mwadi?
Sure. One of the strategies that's been used both by governments as well as community-based organizations is to upgrade the training to traditional birth attendants, because the majority of African women continue to utilize traditional birth attendants when it's time for delivery of their children. And so it's very important that these TBAs have the capacity to deal with complications, because what usually happens is that when there are complications, that's when the deaths occur. And so there's a very strong emphasis on upgrading the skills of the skilled attendants, making sure that they're then linked to referral centers, to health centers that can treat any kind of complications that they're not able to deal with. And one of the challenges that we've heard over and over again from women when asked, you know, why they didn't go to a provider, a skilled provider, or why they didn't go to a health center. It continues to be lack of transport, lack of access to the health center, the health facility. And so I think we also need to place attention on the fact that the infrastructure is not set up for women to really take advantage of the services. And this is a critical issue because we're talking about women's lives.
Does anyone else want to add anything to that? Okay. Zimbabwe was once known as the breadbasket of Southern Africa. In 2002, the UN's World Food Program and Food and Agricultural Organization estimated that about 6 million Zimbabweans require food aid. But these days, political instability and government ineffectiveness prevent thousands of people from receiving food aid. The Land Redistribution Program of 2000 removed many long-term farmers from their land, resulting in a significant drop in agricultural production. The United Nations has downgraded Zimbabwe's status to least developed country, which the Zimbabwean government has not accepted, even though this designation would provide debt relief. Given this situation, how can we ensure the neediest actually receive food? Dr. Leslie, maybe you want to start with that one.
Well, the situation of Zimbabwe is certainly regrettable as an understatement, and there are obviously a number of other situations. It tends to be the type of news that we hear about in Africa, which are the emergency situations, the refugee situations, people in refugee camps in Chad fleeing the genocide in Darfur, Sudan, for example. And those are situations where we need to bring in some kind of immediate food aid to prevent people from starving. Although even there, I think we've come to learn that it's not terribly efficient usually to transport the food all the way from North America or Europe. It may be better to purchase food for Zimbabwe, say, in a nearby country like South Africa, and then you're not spending so much money on transportation and you're actually providing a market for other African farmers. Without wanting to in any way understate the suffering and need that go on through emergencies, either as a result of drought or as a result of war or government mismanagement, and certainly Zimbabwe shows signs of being both government mismanagement and drought. I just want to emphasize that most of the hunger and undernutrition on the African continent is due to what is sometimes called the silent emergency of chronic malnutrition due to poverty and low incomes. And so if we really want to do something about undernutrition, that's the problem that we're going to have to address.
Would anyone else like to add anything to that?
I feel compelled to add something because I've worked in Zimbabwe for 13 years, and I am very passionate about working in Zimbabwe. And I just want to say, don't give up on that country. I mean, we are able to do our work and reach the people that we need to reach with HIV prevention. Things will change there, and I hope that people... The double suffering of not wanting to give aid because you think that things might be mismanaged with the fact that, to a certain extent, they might be, and the problems they're having, I think, is something that we just really need to be wary of. Things will change.
That raises the question of what advice. You say things will change.
They will.
But a lot of people do feel, I think, when they are contemplating giving aid or sending anything at all to Africa, that it will not get to the people who need it most. Can any of you address what actually happens on the ground when the aid comes?
I feel like I'm monopolizing this.
You're not monopolizing it.
It depends on where the aid comes from. Because, I mean, for example, if it's money that's aid can be part of research. And so for example, most of my money comes from the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation and from the National Institutes of Health. And I work with collaborators in the University of Zimbabwe, and I think we're pretty good at getting it where we need to get it. And most of the national AIDS coordinating agencies in countries which have to include people from all of the ministries, the Ministry of Health, Ministry of Education, you know, their equivalent of the State Department, I think do a reasonable job. I mean, I'm not saying there's no corruption anywhere, but I think that in general we do an okay job, pretty good job.
Yes, Mawadi.
If I can add that the community-based organizations are overlooked, they are very much overlooked.
Agreed.
And, you know, while the governments tend to be the first point of choice, in fact, I think the greater efficiency happens at the community level. And so we have a huge unmet need among those community-based organizations, and to the extent that a lot more funding can be channeled towards them. I'll put in a plug for the Global Fund for Women. We do have relationships on the ground. A lot of us, we believe in the strategy of building relationships with people on the ground who have years and years of experience addressing these challenges and being able to scale up what they're already doing. And so I think those heroic stories and you know, those examples of what is going right in Africa are not being told, and so we should tell those stories.
Yes, yes, Dr. Leslie.
I would just support certainly what Mahdi has just said, that, and I think that, for example, the Freedom from Hunger's collaborators are primarily credit unions and small financial agencies that, again, are completely indigenous, local. And it's not so much a question anymore with our strategy and the strategy of increasing numbers of groups of transferring large amounts of aid that go through government bodies, which does have many problems, including the possibility of corruption, but rather of providing strategic technical assistance and some perhaps targeted financial assistance, but again, that goes through community-based organizations, credit unions, other groups that are actually on the ground who actually know the needs of and have relationships with the target communities as well.
One of the problems is the big ticket donors for treatment. For example, the U.S. government through the PEPFAR and Global Fund require, I mean, what you guys say is absolutely right, but they require that it goes through ministries and government agencies. So that's an earmark for how that money has to be dispersed.
Anyone else want to add anything on that question? Clearly, the food situation creates a problem with refugees crossing borders, going into other countries looking for food. That, of course, also is part of the political upheaval as well. How does this make it harder for you to deal with some of the health issues that are going on? Dr. Leslie, you want to start?
The health issues are always difficult to deal with in a refugee situation. People have been displaced, whether they cross borders or they're internally, what are called internally displaced people in essentially refugee camps within their own country of origin. They, perhaps in my mind, the bigger problem is that they have usually, with no choice of their own, been uprooted from their own land where they could grow food, from their own communities where they could help each other, from their own environments where they have some idea of how to survive, and then they're all crowded together. They often don't. Mwadi mentioned clean water. They often don't have access to clean water, and infectious diseases can start running through those refugee camps. So it's a microcosm, in a sense, of the worst that we can have. But it affects too many people, but it is still not the problems that are affecting the large majority of the people in Africa.
It's time now for us to go to the audience for questions. If you do have a question, please come to the microphone here. I would ask you, if you have a question, to make it a question and not a dissertation, and to keep your question reasonably short so that we can get in as many questions as possible. So please quickly now go to the microphone, and we will start. We have our first questioner, and address your question to one of the panelists or to all of them.
Hello, my name is Anite Ekinem, and I'm with an organization called Wireless Africa. Our mission is to provide high-end wireless mesh networking to enable e-health and distance education. I myself just got back from a conference in Addis Ababa, UN Conference on E-Learning, where there were a number of examples of teaching nurses, et cetera, over adult long distances, really leveraging some of the resources that they have. So my question to each one of you is, how can internet technology actually be used to help solve some of these problems? Thank you.
Who would like to start?
Well, you sort of answered it yourself. I mean, I think there's incredible potential. You can do long-distance learning and training, access to journals. There's a myriad of tools that are available. I mean, even as I'm sure you know, using where you can actually sort of simulate surgeries, you know, over the web. So I think it's an incredible resource. And if you can get up our bandwidth everywhere, I'd be extremely grateful.
Any of the other panelists want to address that? Dr. Keesley.
In fact, there are programs at Berkeley now in the CITRIS. It's a California institute that's really devoted to getting wireless technology out in the developing world, because oftentimes the phone might be the only way to get internet out to people.
Mm-hmm. All right, next. Did you want to add something, Mawadi?
Yes, just to give one example, that within social movements, the internet has been used as a mobilization tool, as a way to organize people and to raise awareness about issues and attention to issues that might get overlooked and that might need government action. And so definitely, you know, whether we're talking about internet or whether we're talking about SMS messaging, those kinds of tools have made a difference with advocacy campaigns.
Next question.
Yeah, speaking, Iska spoke a little bit on the government interaction with the leaders and possible corruption and how well your organizations do. Speaking specifically like in Zimbabwe, where corruption and government appointments, government mismanagement leads to misappropriation of government, local government funds, how much interaction do your organizations have with the political office in the different African countries, and how does that affect where your money goes and how it's distributed?
Dr. Padian, I think he's probably addressing that to you.
All of my work in Zimbabwe is done through the University of Zimbabwe, so it's connections that they make up and we have an excellent relationship with the Minister of Health, who's really a terrific guy, Mugabe. We certainly don't have obstacles put in our way. He knows that HIV causes AIDS. It's not the case in all African countries, and we have actually had no problems that way. I'm well aware of the other ones, though.
Any of the others want to address that? Okay. Next question.
Hi, my name is Susan Ross. First, I just wanted to share with everyone that there's a very new, exciting technology being developed at University of San Francisco with Sue Ellen Miller, because postpartum hemorrhage is the number one cause of maternal death worldwide. And Nancy, I was wondering if you could speak to the feminization of HIV/AIDS in Africa.
Yeah. Well, Kofi Annan coined that term. I don't remember exactly what year, but for me, it's really what, you know, Maudie's been saying. Women have always been at increased susceptibility to HIV. They are at greater risk for almost all sexually transmitted infections, and I think sort of what's happening now is the numbers are catching up, and people are starting to realize that, especially there, that women are at greater risk. So it's always been there. It's now more apparent.
Anyone else want to say anything?
Thanks
on that?
For the pitch about Sue Ellen's work. It's great.
do you want to elaborate on it?
Well, I'm not. If she's listening, I'm going to do her a disservice. She has a. Now she's going to kill me because I forget the name of it. But it's a suit that actually applies pressure and prevents, in cases of postpartum hemorrhage, when you talked about issues of transport, I can't remember who talked about that. Allows the bleeding to stop with enough time so that you can actually get to a hospital and get care, because many women die simply because they can't get to where they need to get to for care, and it's being rigorously evaluated, and it's really terrific work.
All right. Next question.
And my question is really about decision-making. You mentioned, Ms. Mukunge, about moving away from more of the centralized decision-making and trying to localize it as much as possible. And I'd just be curious to hear your comments on the strengths you see of that, as well as ways of improving the quality of decision-making that occurs on a local level, and what are the means towards that?
We're actually seeing a trend in governance towards decentralization. And so there are various processes where decisions that were normally in federal government are being done at the district level and being done at the local level. And women's organizations are seeing this as an opportunity for them to also have access to decision-making in their local communities, that they don't necessarily have to do advocacy and get to positions in parliament, that they can actually be able to have this kind of impact locally. And it's happening little by little. I don't think that the problem of corruption is endemic to Africa. And so even though everyone's concerned about that, it happens, but there are so many good people. A lot of what I hear and what I have seen is that you find the people who are working effectively, you build partnerships with them, and the media will always jump on negative publicity. We rarely hear good news, you know, about Africa in the media. And so, again, I think the untold stories are the good stories.
Yeah, I think you might find a few billion got lost in our government somewhere. Next question.
Hi, my name is Amanda Watson. I'm a representative for Global Service Corps. We do HIV/AIDS and sustainable agriculture projects in Tanzania and in Thailand. But my question was addressing, I think it was Dr. Leslie who brought up the role or who is the best advocate or the best tool in working on breaking sexual taboos and doing cultural work and HIV/AIDS work in Africa. And I'm wondering, I think that that is a very good point, and I believe in that very strongly. And I'm wondering what you believe the role is for existing NGOs that are working in Africa on those issues.
Well, I'm not actually sure that it was me that made that particular point, but I would just say, and I think actually this point was already made either by Nancy or Mwadi earlier, that there are a lot of indigenous NGOs that are made up of, that we almost never hear about unless we have the good fortune to work in Africa, that have sprung out of local self-help groups or local financial organizations. And they tend to be the ones who both know the conditions best and also have the really long-term relationships, because a lot of the problem, even with good NGOs that are based outside the country, is that they'll go in for as long as the funding lasts, and then they can't keep working there anymore. And so we have kind of a horrible record in Africa of starting things and then not seeing them through.
All right. Next question.
Hi. My name is Basil Stamos. I'm the director of corporate philanthropy for a private investment firm, and we fund projects in the developing world, particularly the Clinton HIV Initiative in Rwanda, along with Partners in Health. And this whole issue of treatment versus prevention is often coming up in these discussions. And I was wondering if the panel could comment on how treatment programs actually complement prevention programs, particularly prevention of mother-to-child transmission, perhaps lowering, you know, viral load and how that decreases transmission, and, you know, basically providing people with a if you view healthcare as a human right, then these sort of arguments become rather moot, I think.
Who would like to comment on that?
Hi.
Dr. Padian?
Yeah, you're right. Of course, you know, if you view it from human rights or a holistic perspective, and you brought up a good example about how the direct effects of treatment, that is by lowering viral load, might have an effect on prevention by decreasing infectiousness. There's an easier way that they complement each other, and that is people are more likely to get screened and tested if there's a treatment, if they're infected. So my vision for a good program, somebody walks in the door, they get screened, they're uninfected, they go into the prevention program, they're infected, they go into care and treatment, and therefore, you reduce stigma. So there's no question that the availability of treatment enhances prevention and vice versa. We just need to do a better job about integrating it.
How widespread is testing, since there are estimates that only about 10 to 25% of people who are HIV positive know that they are HIV positive?
It depends on the area, and so it's hard. Maybe someone else has better figures, but there are some very innovative programs now, community-based voluntary counseling and testing with mobile testing where they're talking. We're still dealing with issues with stigma, and I think stigma is really interfering with people's ability to get tested. Certainly the availability of treatment should decrease that, but also there are programs that really mobilize the community to talk about HIV, to talk, come out if you're infected, and to increase testing.
Yes, Mwadi.
I would put in another plug for integrated services. Because of the stigma, it does no good really just to, you know, put an HIV/AIDS program out there because, you know, people do feel self-conscious and they don't want other people to know. There are ramifications if other people learn of their status. Women can be thrown out of their homes. People can lose their jobs. And so it's very important, I think, to offer services. Whether it's for treatment, you also have malaria, you also have primary health care, that it all be in the same space. Mm-hmm. So that way, absolutely, you know, there's a little bit of privacy as to why you're going into that particular facility.
Anyone else want to add anything on that question? Thank you. Next question.
Hi, Brian Taylor, private citizen. I've got a question about Africa in general. When I think about Africa or I hear it on the news, it gets bottled into a very small entity, and Africa is such a huge continent. And what I'm curious to know is, how does the attribution of funding take place? Where are the pockets actually happening? Who gets more funding? How does that distribution actually take place? Is that an issue or not across countries? And then the other question, I'm just curious, Ms. Mukenge, how are the men, or is there an effort to integrate men into the local learning of what's happening in the communities?
In prevention, you mean?
In prevention,
okay.
Yes.
Why don't we take the first one? Dr. Kiesling, when we talked about that $225 million that the U.S. government may give to malarial research, how does that get distributed in terms of what countries it helps? Does it just go into a general fund and then whatever comes out of that is distributed across countries?
You know, I think one of the problems is that even when countries have the ability to buy the drugs, for instance, anti-malarial drugs, often they don't do it. So the drugs are made available to them, the funding might be made available to them, and then they don't purchase.
And why would that be?
Problems with the government, complacency, and it could be any number of reasons.
So there needs to be more education then? In these countries,
certainly,
when the drugs are there, that
right,
this can be helpful
right
to people. And the second question, who wants to take that one in terms of what's being done with men to help with them in the education process on prevention?
I think it's very important to involve men because as much as some of these strategies directly target women, at the end of the day, the women have to go home and try to negotiate new practices or new ways of thinking about sexuality with their mates, with their partners. And so a lot of these organizations do have strategies to reach men, and they do have resource persons or staff members also that can talk to men directly. Maybe those men, you know, they're able to talk to other men and be listened to sometimes in a way that is more effective than if women are doing the talking. And so I think the strategies have to be varied. And the Global Fund for Women funds women-led organizations, but that doesn't mean that the messages only reach women. What happens is that messages are spread out to entire communities, and we're trying to correct imbalances. And so we're trying to also make people understand that this is not something that's going to threaten. It has to be done in a way that's non-threatening and really looks at what's going to be the good for the whole.
What have you found is the most effective way to spread the prevention message? Is it through mass media? Is it through one-to-one contact of health workers or social workers going into communities? What seems to be most effective?
A variety of strategies. I think you can't really say only pick one, but definitely theater tends to be a strategy where you can talk about topics that are maybe difficult to do in a one-on-one setting or difficult to do in a lecture setting. Theater has been used. Also, peer educators. There are a lot of people that are being trained as peer educators, as community health workers. The media, for sure, radio campaigns, just getting discussions on issues that maybe were not discussed, you know, 5 years ago or 10 years ago, that's a huge step forward. And so we're seeing a lot of this happening. And I think actually one of the things which has lapsed here in the U.S. is that you don't see the same intensity in public education around HIV as you did when the epidemic first broke out. And so I think that, you know, most Americans still have the information from 15 years ago as opposed to all the developments that have occurred since then.
Yes.
I just wanted to add one thing on the bringing men in, is that one thing we've learned out of the Credit with Education projects that Freedom from Hunger is involved with, which are focused on women. It's women having the loans and women receiving the information. But because they have a little bit more income and because they tend to have a little bit more knowledge, they gain a certain level of self-confidence and they gain a certain level of greater respect in their households and communities. And so it actually strengthens their position to negotiate with the men and their families about practicing some of the new, whether it's sexuality or food-related practices.
All right, and I think this will be our last question because, unfortunately, we're out of time. Yes.
This last. It's my understanding that one of the reasons for malnutrition in Africa is inefficient farming, ineffective water control and storage of water and dealing with the natural changes. Have there been any attempts at making microfinance help women become effective, better, more effective in agriculture? I understand that many women are working on the land. But how can microfinance be integrated with this? Or I don't mean you can answer that, but has there been effective accomplishment of this?
Yes, there has. And you're certainly right that there are problems on the food production side, and there are things that can be done, not so much to teach African farmers to be better farmers, but to give them access to better inputs, more reliable water supplies, high-yield seeds, pesticides where they're going to use them, and loans to women or men, whoever are the farmers, and many of them are women, will help this. But I just, maybe this is a good point to end on. I want to be clear that the main problem for malnutrition, undernutrition in Africa is not inadequate food. The food is really there on the continent. The main, maybe not with the margin that we would like, but the main problems are in the distribution and consumption side, that families are just too poor to be able to reliably purchase the food that's there. So we can do more on the supply side, but we really need to focus on the purchasing power, household side as well.
And do you have a quick solution for that?
Well, I would say among the projects like the Global Funds and like Freedom from Hunger's Credit with Education, making microloans to women, giving them greater health and nutrition information to make the right purchases and changes in their practices has been shown absolutely to reduce child malnutrition.
Well, thank you to our panelists, Dr. Jay Kiesling of UC Berkeley, Dr. Joanne Leslie of Freedom from Hunger, Mwadi Mukenge of the Global Fund for Women, and Dr. Nancy Padian of UC San Francisco. Let's give them a hand. Now this meeting of Inform and the Commonwealth Club is adjourned.